Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. How does America get its electricity? Writer and photojournalist Molly Seltzer set out to find out in a cross-country project called Electric America, documenting the sources and delivery mechanisms for electrical energy in states across the country. It's funded by a grant from the Shapiro Traveling Fellowship at the George Washington University, and she described it for us earlier this morning.
I actually had been brainstorming this for a while. One of those things that kind of keeps you up at night a little bit. I was thinking about, during my environmental studies past, the systems that underpin our day-to-day activities. And so I wanted to see exactly where the wastewater goes, exactly where the power comes from. And then I started touring some facilities. There is a wastewater treatment plant in Atlantic City, which is not far from my family's beach house in New Jersey. And one of my vacations from work, I basically just decided to take a tour. They have public tours, and I saw the wind turbine that they have on site, the solar they have on site, wastewater treatment, and it kind of came together that I really enjoy learning on the ground, and I would love to keep doing this in some kind of full-time capacity. So I am a photographer and a writer, kind of like a multimedia journalist, if you will, and I take my camera around wherever I go, and my notebook, and my recorder as well, and the three things basically make up my platform and how I communicate with people.
Why energy as a subject?
Energy is so critical to climate change and fighting it, both from a climate mitigation and adaptation standpoint. There's a lot of opportunity for improvement. Electricity and heating across the world account for 1/4 of all global greenhouse gas emissions, which is a huge amount of emissions from one sector. So I figured electricity is something everybody cares about because everybody has an energy bill. And then additionally, it's such a big impact area that electrifying a lot of end uses and connecting people to their power source could potentially be a turning point that really brings the world to a clean energy system.
You know, in projects like this, documentary projects, you frequently find things you didn't expect to find. Has that been the case for you?
Yeah, definitely. For me, I've actually seen a lot on islands, which are really innovative and unique. So even in small communities, I've actually sometimes found the most progressive, creative solutions to energy problems. So for example, on Kauai, I'm here right now, they have a solar and battery storage facility. Seems pretty simple in concept, put a bunch of batteries together along with some solar power, but the impact that it has is massive. The facility can power up to 4,500 homes for 4 hours, the battery storage facility. And it's pretty much one of those cases where it's just worked out very well. Kauai Island Utility Cooperative and Tesla partner to make this site. And it's one of the biggest battery facilities in the entire world that's operational. So you think about Kauai, and it's such a small island, not a lot of domestic resources on the island, and they came up with this pretty progressive scheme that they were able to get operational, and it was wonderful to see on the ground.
It's also, your project sort of makes you think that if you could take the best practices of all 50 states, you might really have something, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the key things to realize for utilities, for consumers, anybody who cares about this, is really just to understand what resources you currently have. So what works on one island might not work on another island, but that's why you're your own island, and you figure out what resources are natural and abundant and how you can harness those to make it work for the community. And that's one of the really nice things about having cooperatives or utilities that are really in touch with the local environment and community.
What are some of the other best practices that you've seen around the country, Molly?
Well, I don't know if I would consider this a best practice, but it's pretty amazing. Offshore wind is really an untapped resource in the United States. Right now, there's only one operational offshore wind farm, and that's off the coast of Rhode Island in Block Island. And I visited that in June of this year, it was incredible to see. Only there are five big turbines about 4 miles off the coast of Block Island, and it sends power back to Block Island and then also via an underwater cable to Rhode Island. And, you know, it only takes up a little bit of space in the ocean, created a fair number of jobs, and it's providing clean power. And it's more than Block Island needs, so a lot does go to Rhode Island. And if you think about the breadth of the ocean and the coastline in the U.S., there's just so much potential capacity to use. So I think for me, offshore wind is such an exciting field and an area of innovation that we can move forward with.
In that area of Rhode Island, did you get an idea of what the, you know, the ratio of what the project costs to the returns that it's giving?
Yeah, so the rate structure is pretty interesting, and there's always a lot of stakeholders and players involved. But effectively, a wind developer developed the actual wind farm. So Block Island Power did not actually develop it itself. It was Deepwater Wind. So Deepwater Wind makes an investment and has a contract with a purchasing authority, with a mainland utility. And then Block Island buys the power from them. So there's a lot of different parties, but the wind company has set it up so they have a return on their investment. I think it might be like 8% per year, something like that. But the ratepayers overall on Block Island are supposed to see a decrease in their energy costs. And most importantly, they're no longer tied to the world price of diesel, which is what they were tied to previously.
In Hawaii, we're still pretty well tied to the price of oil because we use quite a bit of oil to produce our energy here, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. But some of the renewables, so Hawaii is about 40% renewable in general across the island. Some have a little bit higher rate, some a little lower rate, but in general around 40%. And as that number increases, the fuel cost will inevitably be affected by, as you wean off oil, your fuel cost changes because you're no longer tied to diesel. So you're able to basically provide a fixed rate if you have a long-term contract with, for example, a solar provider or a wind farm. So that really helps provide some stability in fuel costs, and utilities are integrating them into their costs and figuring out how it works for them and the ratepayer.
So you're seeing that happen in Hawaii?
Yes, definitely. The Kauai Island Utility Cooperative wouldn't have been able to integrate solar and batteries if it wasn't going to be financially beneficial for them in the long term and for the ratepayer. One of the things about cooperatives is that they don't have shareholders. They just serve their ratepayers or their consumers and then their employees. So as long as it's good for the ratepayer in the long term, they seem to be incentivized to invest in these new opportunities.
How many states have you got left to go, Molly?
I have not hit all 50 states. I would love to go across the country entirely, but I've probably been to about 11, and maybe I'll go to 3 or 4 more before the fellowship is up.
Molly Seltzer is founder and chief storyteller of Electric America, as well as a Shapiro Traveling Fellow at the George Washington University. We'll share the links where you can follow her project on The Conversation Facebook page.
If you turn on a children's TV channel during a commercial break, you'll see ads clearly geared toward boys.
Hot Wheels leading the way.
And very different ads geared toward girls.
Makeup, Lindsay, I'm gonna make you beautiful.
We're not going to be getting her baby dolls and Barbies.
The revolutionary act of trying to raise a child free of gender stereotypes, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a progress report from HECO about Hawaii's clean energy future. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a dramatic example of evolutionary adaptation in our islands. This one is a flightless moth that lives only in a high mountain area on one island. It lives on barren, rocky slopes where high winds and cold temperatures make flying difficult. Although its evolutionary ancestors could fly, this unusual moth has shortened wings that are useless for flying. It gets around by hopping, much like a grasshopper. It's able to leap up to 10 times its body length. And during its caterpillar stage, it spins webs in rock crevices, feeding on the dead leaves caught in the web as they blow past. Its scientific name is Thyrocopa apatella, and it has more than one English name, but today we're looking for the name of the mountain that is its exclusive habitat. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, I'm Wade Camburn of Hawaiian Style Band. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Hawaii faces its own unique set of challenges in its efforts to convert to clean, renewable energy, challenges brought about in large part by geography. The isolation of the islands and their separation from one another have contributed to the difficulties of weaning our islands from the need to burn petroleum to produce electricity, which Hawaii does far more than any other state. The Hawaiian Electric Company has a legal mandate as well as a broad base of popular support for its conversion to clean renewable energy, and Peter Rossegg, its senior spokesman, is in our studio with a progress report. Hi, Peter. Thanks for coming in.
Chris, nice to be here.
You know, in the previous interview, we heard several, attractive-sounding alternatives.
Right.
Offshore wind, solar, all these other ways of producing energy that are catching on in small projects throughout the country. And it's easy to say, why don't we do that in Hawaii tomorrow? Why don't we?
Right. Well, all those things that you mentioned, offshore wind and more solar and more onshore wind and waste to energy and more geothermal, they're all in our power supply plan. Mm-hmm. That's going to get us to 100% clean renewable energy by 2045 or a little earlier. And everybody wishes we could get there more quickly.
Yeah.
There are two things about that. First of all, we don't want to go so fast that we commit to a technology that's replaced by something better down the road. So you do want to have a certain level of gradual acquisition of, mm-hmm. of renewables. And the other thing is, even if tomorrow the ship pulled into Honolulu Harbor with every wind mill and wind turbine or every solar panel we needed to go, our grid is not ready for it. And mm-hmm. so we are spending a lot of money and a lot of time and effort on grid modernization, also on just hardening the grid against the weather. Mm-hmm. We are spending a lot of money on digital communications and digital technology that allows us to integrate more solar, more wind, more of these other kinds of, especially the kinds of energy that are not totally dependable, and like a power plant that a traditional power plant is, whether it's fueled by petroleum or by biodiesel or any other kind of liquid fuel. So we have to do these both these things. And while the renewable energy projects are much more visible, the grid upgrades and the things like that are harder to see and harder to understand.
Why does the grid require updating?
Sure.
To adapt to solar and wind.
you know, for about 100 years, we've had an energy system where we had some big power plants in the middle of the spider's web, so to speak, that sent power out in one direction out to the customers. Now, as we all know, we have a system that sends electricity in many different directions. People are generating power on their rooftops. People we have wind farms here on Oahu up on the North Shore and in Kahuku. We have solar farms, most of them out, big solar farms, most of them out on the west side, and there's going to be one in Waipio. And so the grid that was designed for a one-way flow and served us well in that regard now has to be adapted to the flow of many different kinds of energy from many different sources. Mm-hmm. And the energy business is not an overnight change business. I mean, McDonald's can bring in a new hamburger tomorrow and change it again in a few weeks. But the kind of investment that's needed to upgrade the grid, to bring in investors to build these power plants and build the wind farms and solar farms, these things all take years.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can't go much. We certainly wish we could go faster, and we're trying to move forward. We're at 26% renewable energy as of the end of last year, which is better than anywhere else in the country that I know of overall, and the average for the Hawaiian Electric Service territories. But, of course, we need to go further.
We also have what's our percentage from petroleum?
Well, since we're at 26 for renewables, we're at 74 for everything else.
For everything else,
and
yeah.
That means overwhelmingly oil, although we do have some coal generation here on Oahu. So I'm not sure. The coal is probably 6 to 8%, something in that range. But, you know, fossil fuel of one kind or another is still, as of last year, as of December, we don't have our figures for this year yet, obviously, was it something like 74%? And most of that's oil.
Nationwide, we're seeing an abrupt shift in direction from the previous presidential administration away from clean, renewable energy.
Yeah, that's certainly troubling on a national and international scale. For Hawaii, the clean power plan that the Trump administration is now looking to abrogate didn't have a lot of effect on us to begin with, because we don't use mainland coal. We have no nuclear. Our oil and the little bit of coal we use here pretty much all comes from Asia. So we were never under those kinds of injunctions. And frankly, we're so far ahead at 26% renewable energy. We're well on our way to meeting state laws for the reduction of greenhouse gases. We're so far ahead, other utilities look to us to ask how we do it. Whatever happens, we're not changing our course. As you said, the community supports going to clean energy. We think it's the right thing for our customers, for our community, and for our company, frankly. And we do have laws. We have the law that requires 100% renewable energy, and we have to reduce greenhouse gases by 2020 to about 16% less than we were generating in 2010. Mm-hmm. And we're well on our way to do that. And nobody is talking here about turning back on any of those things. Nationally, you know, we'll have to see what happens with this clean power plan and how much the Trump administration can delay or change things. And I'd like to think it's a bump in the road, and it's not there's so many utilities going to clean energy. There's so many utilities trying to get off coal in the United States and abroad. I don't think we're not doing enough right now to deal with climate change. And this is not a helpful thing, but it's not going to reverse things. And it's not going to, very frankly, I think whatever they decide to do will be tied up in court for the next 4 years. I mean, we see how other things, Hawaii taking the lead against the Muslim ban and so forth. So I don't doubt that as soon as the EPA, the EPA tries to undermine the clean power plan totally, that they're going to be in court. But, we're just going to continue doing what we do and hope that the rest of the world keeps going. Many countries are more committed than the United States to this. So that's where we are.
One of your challenges as a communicator, Peter, is it's always tough to talk about things that take time
right
to the public. you know, the whole balance, you know, the answering the question, why don't we just have wind power for everything tomorrow? Part of that is just the sheer explaining to the public amount of not just how much, but how long it's going to take, right?
Right. And that's why I think your previous guest and her project to be out there and looking at these things is to the good. You know, I've found again and again that if I can sit down with somebody for 20 or 30 minutes and explain the situation, they come away from that perhaps not convinced that of everything that I have to say to them, but they come to realize that we face the challenges and we're making a good faith effort. And, you know, for many, many years, the electric utility industry sort of said to people, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. You don't really have to worry about it. Well, that's changed. People do have to worry about it. People have to make decisions in their own lives that will affect, you know, whether they're going to put solar on their roof or whether they're going to get energy efficient appliances or whether they're going to get an electric vehicle. So they have to understand things that they didn't have to understand before. Buying a light bulb today is a little bit of a PhD challenge, right? It used to be you went into the store and it was 40, 60, or 100.
Right.
Now you have to read the labels. Life has gotten more complicated in that way. But so we can't just, we just have to patiently try to get to people and try to explain why this is in their own interest, because people are concerned about their pocketbook, they're concerned about their environment, and they're concerned about the reliability of their electricity. And those are the three things we have to work on all the time.
We'll be keeping track of that in the years to come, Pete. Thanks very much.
Anytime. Glad to see you, Chris.
Peter Rossegg is Hawaiian Electric Company's senior spokesman, has been with HECO for 15 years. He's also a member of the HPR Community Advisory Board.
This week on Says You, the cast plays the game with determination and deception.
That is true, but that's not what I'm looking for.
I don't care what you're looking for.
We got it right.
You got it right on the wrong show.
Spirited and civil, brainy and boisterous, it Says You. This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
Aloha. I'm taiko artist Kenny Endo. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
So-called sit-lie bans, which forbid sitting or lying on public sidewalks in designated areas as a way of getting homeless people off the streets, are widely criticized, described as criminalizing homelessness and making it even more difficult for people to leave homelessness behind. Despite the opposition, the Honolulu City Council is going ahead with measures that would expand sit-lie to all public sidewalks on Oahu. Civil Beat reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim has more in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Natanya.
Good morning.
This is the major difference in this this proposal. It used to be that sit-lie bans were regional, and you ended up just moving people to some place where there wasn't a sit-lie ban. Now there isn't going to be any place that doesn't have one, right?
Exactly. The proposal by Councilmember Ernie Martin, who represents the North Shore, is to expand the sit-lie ban on all public sidewalks on Oahu.
So it's kind of, I don't know, it used to be, I don't know where you're going to go, but you can't be here, but there were places to go. Now there isn't any place to go.
If the bill passes, yes.
If the bill passes, yeah.
Yeah, so Councilmember Martin's argument is that there's no use in shuffling people around. It's not effective to simply move people from, say, urban Honolulu to more rural areas that don't have sit-lie bans.
Well, now, no matter where you try to sit or lie, you're going to end up with a ticket, a fine, and some legal problems, which are going to probably keep you homeless a little longer, I would think.
Right. The argument that the administration and a number of city council members have made is they call this compassionate disruption. And that means that people are disrupted from living on the streets and encouraged or forced to go into homeless shelters. On the other hand, there are critics who say, for whatever reason, if people don't want to go into shelters, they don't feel safe or comfortable there, then it's, you know, an island-wide ban would essentially make it criminal to be homeless. And there's some legal concerns about this. The city of Los Angeles had a citywide sit-lie ban and actually lost a suit that was brought against them because it essentially criminalized being homeless.
Well, even if every homeless person on Oahu, for example, agreed tomorrow to go into a shelter, there wouldn't be shelters to accommodate them.
Exactly. And that's why the case brought against Los Angeles was successful in beating, you know, the sit-lie ban, because if you're going to tell people they can't live on the street, you have to have an alternative.
Yeah.
And there aren't enough shelter beds for all of the people who are homeless in Hawaii.
That would seem to leave this law, bill, assuming it passes, extremely vulnerable to legal challenge.
Yes, and earlier the mayor did veto a bill, another expansion of sit-lie, because it went onto a residential street. And even just, you know, going from a commercial street to a residential street is, you know, makes the bill vulnerable to legal challenges.
Because of the difference in zoning, residential zoning?
Right, exactly.
This looks as like the kind of thing we're going to want to keep track of, Natanya, to see. What are the expectations of the bill to pass?
That's a good question. It passed first reading with only one vote against it.
Yeah.
The vote was by council member Brandon Elefante, who represents Waipahu and Aiea. He's consistently voted against sit-lie, but seven other council members voted for it, with one person being absent. And, it's important to mention that on first reading, most bills are passed because they have to go through three different full council meetings, which takes, you know, a couple months.
Yeah.
So usually council members like to introduce the bill initially just to at least give it a conversation and start the debate about the topic.
Well, this is a debate is not likely to end anytime soon, Natanya. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim. Hawaii in the 1930s presented itself as an island paradise, and it was for a moneyed elite. But as the infamous Massey case, a sordid and headline-grabbing story of rape and revenge, showed the world, it was also a place where the wealthy and well-connected, if they were the right color, could get away with murder. David Carroll's play Massey Kaha Hawaii holds nothing back in its retelling of the alleged rape of Thalia Massey and the all-too-real murder of Joseph Kaha Hawaii. Noah Schutz is one of the student actors in the upcoming Windward Community College production. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, Noah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Taking on these roles, and you have more than one role in this play, including the attorney Clarence Darrow, was an education for you, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. The entire production process was always a learning experience for me. I found it interesting going through the play, being able to pick up a piece of history that I had never heard of before in school, and I don't know why that was. It's a very key piece of Hawaiian history, not only Hawaiian history, but American history in general.
It got the attention of the nation directed to Hawaii, very much so, because it was a scandalous story set against a tropical background, right?
Yes, indeed. We were almost thrown into martial law because of it.
Yeah. Let's outline the story quickly. Thalia Massey was a Navy wife,
mm-hmm.
who came disappeared from a party. Was it the Waikiki Yacht Club?
It was the Alawai Inn.
Alawai Inn. Disappeared from a party, came back a couple of hours later, alleging that she had been assaulted by four local men. Accurate?
Yes, indeed. She left the inn and was supposedly or allegedly assaulted on a walk that she decided to take around midnight, to which she ended up at home somehow, called her husband, Thomas Massey, and explained that she had been assaulted by four Hawaiians who she swore was Hawaiians.
Mm-hmm. And later that night, five men were arrested?
Yes, those five men were arrested with little to no evidence. Based on allegations by a rich white woman.
Mm-hmm.
And those men were then taken to trial, prosecuted, had their names dragged through the dirt, and were basically stained for the rest of their lives. And a very unfortunate turn of events.
Exonerated in trial, though, right?
Yes. Eventually, yes. The Pinkerton Report was released, which did clear their names, but it was unfortunately squashed by a local businessman.
And then Joseph Kahavai was murdered.
Yes, Joseph Kahavai was picked up by Grace Fortescue, the mother of Thalia Massey, and three other men, including Thomas Massey, and was murdered, all because they thought that he did commit the crime and that he was trying to hide his guilt.
And Grace Fortescue Massey was later punished how?
Unfortunately, she wasn't punished at all. They ended up getting out of their very obvious guilt in murder, and she spent the rest of her time living her life as though nothing had ever happened.
Didn't she spend an hour sitting in the governor's office?
Yeah, she spent an hour drinking tea in the governor's office, which is...
That was her house arrest. That was the punishment.
It went from a sentence of 10 years down to 1 hour in the governor's office because of the increasing amount of public pressure being put on poor Governor Judd. And he eventually conceded to the overwhelming pressure and gave them an hour instead of 10 years.
How does the play address these events?
The play gives you an outlook on everything, sort of like an overview of the case, but we do put emphasis on certain parts of the case. I don't want to ruin the play for you.
You won't.
So we address the murder, the case. I get to play Clarence Darrow in what is almost the climax of the show.
And he was brought out to Hawaii to defend Grace Fortescue Massey, right?
Yes, he was brought out by a conglomerate of white people in the mainland who said that they needed the greatest defense attorney of all time to come down and defend the four murderers who were obvious murderers and pled guilty.
This had its own impact on you, didn't it? Taking on this role.
Yeah, it was a great honor for me to be able to get the role of Clarence Darrow, because everybody will remember Clarence Darrow, and I hope that everybody will be okay with or accept the way that I play him. And I want to put on a right sort of stance for Darrow and for all of the characters in the play.
It's pretty important when you're dealing with a historical subject to avoid creating false impressions, yeah?
Yeah, we try to stay as true as possible to the whole case. We don't deviate from the actual timeline, I guess, of the play. We try to give accurate representation of what happened, what life would have been back then, and we don't hold back blows, in a sense.
It would be nice to say that this was a representative of an archaic way of thinking that we can now have now buried in the past. Do you think that's true?
To a degree. I think as there is always going to be that tinge on American society from the old ways that we used to live in the 1930s. I don't think we'll ever get over that, and I don't think we should ever stop talking about what did happen, the tragedies that did occur. Even though it was 70, 80 years ago, it still affects our life now.
You will always hear people, when you talk about a historical tragedy or something that is, you know, brings a certain amount of shame to local cultures, and why dredge it up? You know, what is the effect of bad memories and evoking ugly memories of our past? Does it undermine us, you know, as a culture, or does it strengthen us?
I don't think it undermines us at all. It's important to remember where you came from in order to figure out who you are now. Mm-hmm. There's always that that old phrase, those who do not learn from the past are doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we don't teach this in public schools, how are we supposed to learn from the mistakes that we made back then? How are we supposed to change future without knowing the past? If we try to hide such a tragedy as the death of Joseph Kahawai, which was a very tragic instance in Hawaiian history and American history, then how can we prevent that from happening in the future? I feel that this is a very important topic to teach to kids in a young age, and I was unfortunate enough not to ever learn about it.
I don't think too many people your age would have learned about it. It'd be interesting to find out, you know, among people who are listening, just how many of them had known this story.
Yeah, I do encourage people my age or people of any age to come down and take in the case of Joseph Kahawai and Thalia Massey and to really learn about this piece of history, this necessary piece of American history.
You know, Noah, one of the things that's different about the play, you could tell just from the title, is it's always referred to as the Massey case,
mm-hmm.
not as the Massey Kahawai case. Which tells you something right there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's important to remember that this whole thing is a tragedy to Joseph Kahawai, not so much Thalia Massey, because, yes, in the end,
he's the one that got murdered.
Yeah, he's the one who got shot in the chest, and they try to write him out of the history books, which is just a tragic thing to think about. I don't even want to put that dark image into my head, but it's necessary in order to understand what the times were like back in the 1930s that we tried to bury this whole thing under the carpet and never think about it again.
Well, it's just got unburied by your production, at least. Thanks very much, Noah.
Thank you.
Noah Schutz, a second-year Windward Community College student studying theater, plays two characters in the production, Massey Kahawai, a detective, an outraged citizen, and Clarence Darrow. That's three characters. The play runs October 20th through the 28th at Windward Community College's Palikū Theater. In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a moth that is found on only one island on only one mountain. Habitat loss has confined this flightless creature to elevations above 2,900 meters. And because it has evolved past its ability to fly with wings that have shortened down through the years, it hops from place to place at 10 times its body length. Flying wouldn't do it much good at the elevations at which it lives on barren, rocky slopes. At the caterpillar stage, it weaves a web that it uses to trap and feed on the dead leaves that blow by. The moth has managed to survive extreme temperature changes that average from 50 to 65 degrees Fahrenheit during the day, often drop below freezing at night. The air is thin and solar radiation intense. We asked you where this critter makes its home, and the answer is Maui's highest peak, Haleakala, the critter in question being the Haleakala flightless moth. And Paul Hanada of Kula, Maui, got the answer right. Congratulations, Paul. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Don't let the name throw you off. The little fire ant is a real danger to Hawaii, an invasive species that often hitchhikes on potted plants. Its bite can leave welts that burn and itch for weeks. It was first detected in Puna in 1999 and is found today throughout Hawaii Island, with populations on Oahu, Maui, and Kauai. Carolyn Dillon is the founder of the Little Fire Ant Hui, a public service project of Hawaii Unite Against Invasives. She lives on the Big Island, where the infestation is at its worst, and on the occasion of Stop the Ant Month, she joins us by phone. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Sure. You've made this your cause, and how did you become aware of the problem? By getting bitten?
No, you know, I have not yet been stung, and I hope I never do, but I hear it is very painful.
Sounds like
I moved here about 3.5 years ago and heard a rumor there were some little fire ants in a vacant lot near my home, and of course, like so many people, not knowing what little fire ants were, I just shrugged my shoulders and carried on. But I soon started hearing about other properties adjacent to this lot that had them as well, and being a morning walker, you know, I get out and start talking to my neighbors, and do you know about the fire ants? And pretty soon, on my walks, within about a half a mile radius, I had collected emails of about 85 people and called a meeting at my home and got in the ant experts and found out that we were uncovering a very, very large infestation of contiguous properties. So our neighborhood really rallied and got together and started working on these to reduce the infestations.
Given the severity of the problem, it's kind of remarkable to me, Carolyn, that so few people know about it.
Yeah, and that's what Little Fire Ant Hui wants to do, and what this month-long campaign that the state puts on every year is all about is we really have to get the word out. It's been called the silent invasion, and we're ready to stop being silent about it. It's you know, a very invasive pest. It's very destructive. And although people have thought for a long time that it was a Big Island problem, you know, this has the high risk of spreading up the whole island chain.
Well, it's not only a silent invasion, it's hard to see, right?
It's hard to see, yes, that's correct. They're very, very tiny, and they don't create mounds. They're actually tucked away in the shade under rocks and moist spots, and they also like to live in trees, so you might not see them there until they fall down and actually sting you. And what makes them also so horrible is that they reach very high densities. So even though they're very, very tiny, when they do fall down on you, you have a whole, like, event. Many of them can rain down on you at the same time, and you're just covered in stings.
And, yeah, we've heard some real horror stories of people sitting under a tree who just literally get rained on by these little guys.
Right, yeah, and here on the Big Island, unfortunately, they're in you know, our public parks and at our beaches. And in fact, a friend of mine told me her husband had flown 2 hours to visit his mother's graveside, and that was closed down because they had to treat the whole graveyard. And you know, it's really impacting this this whole island. And there are still, though, so many people, surprisingly, who haven't heard much about them or don't know anything about them. But those who do, we're starting to rally and get together and work on this.
How do you find them?
Well, the survey method is to take chopsticks or popsicle sticks, put a very thin smear of peanut butter on one side, and so that you can find them once you've placed them in the garden, paint the other end a bright orange or red paint, mm-hmm. and tuck them away in the shade, moist locations, up in the crook of trees. The little fire ant loves fruit trees. They love palms. Palms would be a little high to put in the crook of those. But bananas, that's a really great one to put your sticks in. Mm-hmm. And you leave them out for about 45 minutes and come back and pick them up. And anything that looks really, really tiny and amber-colored, often they don't hang on very well. So if they start falling off the stick, you might be suspicious and collect up your ants, put them in a baggie, and freeze them 24 hours prior to inspection.
Freeze them?
Yes, freeze overnight. Nobody wants live fire ants mailed in.
That makes sense. And then what, mail them in to whom?
Well, typically that has been the pattern. You can mail them into the Hawaii Ant Lab here on the Big Island, or the Big Island Invasive Species Committee, or the Department of Ag. But each county has its own Department of Ag that they can mail them into, and they're able to identify them for you under a scope.
And then what do they do?
Then they would contact you, and each county has its own Invasive Species Council, and they'll train you up and give you all the latest products and protocols. What they do is really work with ant behavior. The queens are hunkered down in her colony, so this product they're using is a slow-release growth inhibitor. It's mm-hmm. Called Tango, and it makes the queen sterile. So the worker ants will eat it mixed with some peanut butter, which they love, and they'll go back and feed it to the queen. And after several months, she'll become sterile, and through attrition, the rest of the workers start dying off.
So if you have an infestation in your garden, for example, you could address it that way. First, you assess the amount of the problem, you find out where they are, and then treat them with this substance, and then it looks like in a few months they should go away. Has that been the pattern?
Yeah, you have to really stay on the program, and this is also what this Stop the Ant month is about, is getting everybody to go to that website, stoptheant.org, and get further information there about exactly the right products, the right resources on your island to help you. And it's on a schedule. You don't want to feed these ants too often, or they won't take the bait. And if you have neighbors that have them, it's best to coordinate with them so all of your ants are eating on the same schedule. but this is really what's bringing the community together, and it's been really exciting to see big neighborhoods working together and kind of just old-fashioned, you know, people getting together and working on this. Also here on the Big Island, just the networks we're creating to get the information out.
Did you must have found a great many people who sort of have been waiting for something like this to come along and saying they might have thought the problem was isolated to their area, and maybe even be surprised to find out that it spread beyond their yard or their region, yeah?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people, there's this feeling of embarrassment maybe or shame that they have the ants, or maybe they don't know they have them. It takes quite a while to even know you have them. And by the time you find out, then you're fully infested. That's why early detection is so important. But, you know, there have been many other community members who have tried to raise the alarm on these fire ants over the years. And, you know, we have to acknowledge all their efforts. But the problem now is they've reached such high densities that now the awareness or the eagerness to do something about it has finally reached a point where people are very quickly getting together on this, and we hope to be able to reach out to more community members as quickly as we can.
Well, Carolyn, it sounds as if it almost has to be a grassroots community effort, one garden, one small infestation at a time.
Yeah, well, the Little Fire Ant Hooey is a grassroots effort, and we're working in partnership with what's been really exciting, just people of all walks of life. We have, you know, farmers and realtors and educators and landscapers, and we get together every month, and we're working on ways to network in our community. We want to try and treat the largest amount of groups as we can at the same time so that, you know, there's economy of scale if you're sharing your products in a group and, again, being on the same schedule. And, you know, and it's just really heartening to see people, you know, rise to the occasion and work together on this.
Well, let's hope you have some success, Carolyn. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Carolyn Dillon is the founder of Little Fire Ant Hooey, a public service project of Hawaii Unite Against Invasives, and you can learn more about it on our Conversation Facebook page.
Next time on Ask Me Another, Adam Conover from the TV series Adam Ruins Everything tells us why he loves debunking common misconceptions. Then move over, Davy Jones, because we've got a game where we've changed monkeys' songs to be about other kinds of animals. So join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Hear Ask Me Another Saturday at noon, right after Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
There's always a wealth of different activities going on throughout the state of Hawaii, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on under the radar in our community. Today, we've got a an interesting documentary shown at the Battleship Missouri, huh, Derek?
Yes, the USS Indianapolis. The legacy tells the story of the greatest sea disaster in U.S. Navy history. In World War II, a Japanese submarine hit the Indianapolis and sank it. Over 800 men floated in waters that were filled with sharks, and after 5 days, only 317 survived. This film will be shown aboard the Mighty Moe's Fantail beginning at 7 p.m., and a Q&A session follows. For ticket information, please go to our website.
This is going to be of interest to a lot of people in Hawaii, Derek, because Captain McVeigh has been, Hawaii has been the site of a rehabilitation effort for the captain of the Indianapolis.
Oh, I see.
Captain McVeigh, father of Kimo McVeigh.
Ah, yeah. Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, that was a big part of his life's effort, was to restore his father's image as commander of that vessel.
Oh, I see. Wow.
So, interesting story.
Yeah.
And here's a story tomorrow on Kauai.
Yes, it is National Farm to School Month. The group Malama Kauai invites people to get a garden ready to feed, educate, and nourish our keiki. Now, this takes place at the Youth Garden on the Waikoa Plantation tomorrow from 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Don't forget to wear closed-toe shoes, bring water, and also sun protection.
And here's a play that originally featured Boris Karloff on Broadway, coming to the Aloha Theater.
That's right. On the Big Island, the dark comedy Arsenic and Old Lace originally debuted back in 1941. It's about a drama critic who has an eccentric family, including two aunts who like to poison lonely men to death. Hence, a dark comedy.
It's pretty dark.
Yeah, right. That is. And it starts tomorrow at 7:30 in the Aloha Theater in Kainaliu in West Hawaii, and it runs through October 22nd.
Well, thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar, and you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll look at Maui sand mining measures taken to present culturally sensitive areas with Maui Council member Don Guzman. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, and find us under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.